Coming up on Weekend America.
Barack Obama is on the air in Arizona. John McCain is on the ground in Pennsylvania. I'm John Moe. We're days away from the election, and things are getting kind of weird. We head to McCain headquarters as he tries to flip a reliably blue state. We'll also check in at Democratic headquarters in McCain's home state of Arizona, where Obama's on the offensive. Plus, as the economy stumbles and fears grow, we're reminded of the Great Depression.
Men would come to our back door begging for food. And one of the things that they really liked were sandwiches made on light bread. They thought that was a real delicacy.
And Halloween's over, but fear remains.
I had a habit of getting upset at the death of movie characters, which is why my father had calmed my incessant whining when Bambi's mother is shot by assuring me that she had merely been kidnapped.
Kidnapped. Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Hey, did you know there's an election on Tuesday? It's true, I checked. You'd think they would have said something about it on the radio. We'll get updates from the ground in just a few minutes. More scary economic news this week also. Negative growth, recession has begun. I have an idea. They should only publish the Wall Street Journal late at night after the kids have gone to bed. Think it'll work? As people worry about a depression, we'll hear some stories about the Great Depression from people who lived it. You can compare and contrast. And we'll hear some of your scariest childhood movie memories. What are you doing this weekend?
This weekend, I'm going to party hop. I'm going to go to several Halloween parties.
We're going to Chicago.
We're going to the zoo.
I love to be a weekend gardener, and it's the fall, and so I'm going to start sowing some seeds.
I think that me and my little boy are going to spend some time together. He's about to go out for basketball for the first time. He's 8 years old.
This weekend, I'm headed to either Jamestown or Sandrock to go climbing with probably four or five of my buddies. Heading out there with the rope and gear and hope we don't hurt ourselves.
Wow, good luck. Those voices came from Boston, Denver, and Birmingham, Alabama. Well, at this stage, the presidential race, more than ever before, is all about electoral math. Which states can the candidates pick off to get to 270 electoral votes and win the presidency? For John McCain's campaign, that means a huge focus on Pennsylvania. Win the Keystone State, he has a chance. Lose it, he's probably doomed. He's down in the polls, but he says that the race is narrowing. Jen Rehill is bureau chief of Public Radio Capital News in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and she joins us live from McCain campaign headquarters there. Hi, Jen.
Hi, John.
Where are you now? What have you been doing today?
Right now, I'm at a place called the West Shore Victory Center. We're in a suburb outside the state capital of Harrisburg in Cumberland County, which is a very Republican area of the state. This morning, I was out with some volunteers, a grandfather and his grandson team, going door to door trying to get out the vote for the Republican Party here in Cumberland County.
And what's the importance of the Harrisburg area in relation to the rest of the state?
Well, this area is part of what's known as the T of Pennsylvania. That's a swath across the north and straight down through the center of the state that is the most conservative and most Republican voting area in the state. Turnout here is crucial for the Republican Party to sort of counterbalance what's expected to be a large turnout of Democratic voters in the southeast in Philadelphia and in the Pittsburgh area in the west.
Such a diverse state, Pennsylvania. What are the political challenges there?
Well, I think one challenge is speaking to the many different demographics in Pennsylvania. You have everything from very urban, very metropolitan Philadelphia to very rural farm country in the middle of the state. Crafting a message that speaks to all of those audiences is different. You know, an interesting thing I saw, Sarah Palin had a rally in Erie this week, and Erie's in sort of the northwest corner of the state, and she said to the crowd, "Hey, how about those Philadelphia Phillies winning the World Series?" And the crowd booed. Now, it might seem stunning to somebody outside Pennsylvania, but western Pennsylvania doesn't like Philadelphia, you know, and I think that's one of those challenges you have here in the state. It's very divided.
Hmm. And Jen, you have a McCain volunteer with you there.
I sure do. This is Dr. Jack Hurd. He's a chiropractor here in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, and I was out going door to door with him, and I'll put him on now.
Hello.
Hello, Dr. Hurd. What have your experiences been going door to door today?
Well, they've actually been very delightful. We've been going door to door in the area we're in. We're mostly retired folks. We're close to retirement, and they, I would say unanimously, all but one family that we went to were all John McCain supporters and Sarah Palin.
Is that typical for your region? This is a community you obviously know pretty well.
Well, it is. I think, at least in the area we were in, it was definitely McCain supporters. And although you do have, I'm sure there were a lot of Obama supporters, but we have a list of names that mostly were Republicans.
Okay. What made you decide to volunteer this weekend?
Well, I've been volunteering right along, and actually when we're done with this call, we're heading over to another center to make phone calls to call Republicans and encourage them to get out and vote. And the reason, our main reason would be the passion we feel for the gross division between the opinions of these two candidates. And the one we do support, of course, is John McCain, and the reason for that is he is pro-life and will, I believe, not just on that issue, but we'll appoint judges that will be sympathetic to the pro-life movement.
So the big issue for you is abortion. Is that something that you're hearing as you go door-to-door as well? Is that the main issue?
Well, it is with many, but not all. I mean, many of them are looking at the economics of it, too. But for me, that is definitely my passion and our family's passion. Also, my daughter and some of her children, and I'm raising two children also from my oldest son, and he's divorced, and we're also making phone calls and, you know, talking to people, and our whole family is very passionate about the abortion issue, and if John McCain is in, hopefully this can be stopped.
And Dr. Hurd, we hear a lot about how much bigger of an organization the Obama organization has and how McCain's is much smaller. How much support are you getting from the McCain camp in terms of organizing your efforts?
Well, they're doing very, very, very good in organizing, and I do agree with you that it appears, and I've not been around Obama's headquarters, but it appears that they have a much larger organization than what we do, in more offices also. But the organization that we've been involved with, the two areas here in Camp Hill area, have been very organized and very supportive.
Dr. Hurd, thank you.
You're welcome.
From Pennsylvania, we head over to John McCain's home state of Arizona. One would think that this would be a gimme for McCain. He's represented the state in the Senate for 20 years. But a recent series of polls show a statistical dead heat between McCain and Barack Obama. And late this week, the Obama campaign announced they would be buying advertising there, suggesting they think it's in play. Reporter Renee Gattell is at the Arizona Democratic Party headquarters. Hi, Renee.
Hey, John.
So how is it looking on the ground there?
Well, it's really interesting because both the McCain and Obama campaigns in Arizona have been working here for a long time, but a lot of their efforts have been focused on New Mexico. So sending volunteers to New Mexico, making phone calls to New Mexico, and people didn't think that Arizona was going to be much of a race. And so since New Mexico is such a swing state, they've been going there. But since these polls came out that you mentioned, there's been this kind of whiplash attention back on Arizona. I'm here at a call center where dozens of volunteers are going to be making calls to Democrats and independents, trying to encourage them to vote for Barack Obama.
Why is John McCain doing worse in his home state than in some other states like Oklahoma, Utah?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You wouldn't think that we would be having this conversation. But I was listening to conservative talk radio on the day that some of these polls came out. And some of these hosts, and these are John McCain supporters, they are angry and feel that John McCain has ignored Arizona and ignored the issues in this state while he's been running for president. They said that he hadn't done enough local radio interviews or local TV appearances, for example. No, these are people who are still supporting John McCain but feel that he has ignored Arizona. But also keep in mind that the Southwest is changing. More people are moving here. The demographics of the Southwest are changing. I mean, you look at Nevada and New Mexico, and those are real toss-up states as well.
Well, if those are obstacles for McCain, then what are the obstacles for Obama?
Well, for Barack Obama, the problem is just trying to beat Arizona's hometown senator. I mean, at the end of the day, McCain still has the advantage here. Arizonans have sent John McCain to the U.S. Senate for 20 years. They probably know him best of all, of any voters in the country. And also, you don't want to forget that Arizona still has more registered Republicans than Democrats.
Right. Well, how is what you're seeing there different this time around from what you know of the Republican effort and the Republican organization in Arizona?
Well, the Republican organization in Arizona is strong, and it always has been. I spoke with a spokesman for Arizona's McCain campaign yesterday who said that their efforts are newly doubly fired up as a result of the recent polls this week. There's a big get-out-the-vote rally planned in Phoenix today by the Arizona McCain campaign, and they're also starting to make automated phone calls to Arizonans, you know, these so-called robocalls to voters to encourage them to vote for John McCain.
Is it hard to get a feeling? I mean, you hear a lot of, you know, the McCain camp saying we're in good shape, the Obama camp saying they're in good shape.
I know.
Is it hard to get a feel for reality at this late stage in the campaign?
Is there reality a couple of days before an election? You know, I have no idea, John. You look at these polls, a couple of them show Obama down by 2 points, a couple of them show Obama down by 5 points, and at the end of the day, you know, we're just going to have to wait and find out Tuesday.
And Renee, you have a volunteer there with you as well.
Yes, I do. Her name is Viva Eichelberg. She lives here in the Phoenix area. She's a yoga teacher, and here I'm going to pass her over to you.
Hello.
Hello, Ms. Eichelberg. Welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here.
Now, you've been canvassing in McCain's backyard. What do people say to you when you go to their door?
Actually, it's very interesting to have. I wear a lot of Obama shirts and buttons, and people are so supportive wherever I walk, into restaurants, into the grocery store, Trader Joe's the other day, every aisle. Love your shirt. Love your buttons. I say, are you voting? Yes, absolutely. I've gotten my vote out. It's electric, the change that's coming about here. And phone calling. Now, granted, we are talking to people that are Democrats and independents, so it's a more receptive crowd. But we're so encouraged that our voices are being heard here in Arizona, and they're seeing that. We do know who the real Senator McCain is here, and we're looking for something different as our president.
And the people who you stumble across who are not Obama supporters, are they speaking about voting for McCain out of a loyalty because he is from Arizona?
You know what, how I approach it, and based on my being a yoga teacher, is I tell them, you know what, I don't really care who you give your money to. Because as you can see that, you know, we're using our money very wisely, the Obama campaign. But when you're at the voting booth, it's between you and your conscience on what you want, the change you want to occur in our country. And you don't have to tell, you know, McCain's not going to know who voted for him personally. And this is something that you're going to have to live with. And I'd really like you to think about the next 4 years or the next 8 years and how this will affect you.
Viva, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me a part of your show.
Viva Eichelberg in Arizona.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
Obama buys an infomercial, McCain hires a plumber, sort of hires him, well, sort of a plumber, and candy variety is threatened. Good news, bad news, no news, next on Weekend America. It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe, and we've arrived at the moment in your weekend when we help you make sense of all that has happened over the course of the week. And that's important in a week where you can't turn your head without seeing Obama, McCain, Palin, Biden, not really Biden, and a Wall Street that you kind of wish would just shut up for a while. Here to sort everything into good news, bad news, and no news is our panel, author David Rakoff. Hi, David.
Hey, John.
Radio host Luke Burbank. Hello, Luke.
Hi, John.
And author Nancy French. Hello, Nancy.
Hi, John.
First up, the Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama bought up a half hour of airtime on several TV networks this week for a primetime address and documentary that even he described as an infomercial. Was this campaign development good news, bad news, or no news?
The New York Post interviewed some of the famous infomercial stars, like the guy who sells the swivel sweeper and the smart chopper. Well, they asked him what they thought about Obama's infomercial. And so their critique of it was that his infomercial spent a lot of time on the depressing problems and very little time on the solution, which was the exact opposite approach that they take to sell the swivel sweeper.
Where, in fact, was the beautiful roast chicken that had just cooked in under 3 minutes, for example? Where was it?
Yeah, call now.
Not to brag, but I was one of the first 1,000 callers, which means I get the fillet knife added to my vote, which is – that's a $40 value right there.
That's nice.
I think it was bad news because if you're someone – who at this point, after 7 years of this campaign, if you literally haven't made up your mind, or if more troublingly, you literally don't know who Barack Obama is at this point, if that is you, don't vote. Sit this one out. This is not the one for you. Start working on the next one and figure out who they are. But I mean, is it possible that there's actually somebody who kind of doesn't know who Barack Obama is and watched this infomercial and thought, I'm going to vote for that guy?
I thought it was no news from the standpoint of, like the two-year campaign and the billion-dollar campaign, this is the new normal. We're just going to have to get used to this sort of thing. But what I thought was bad news about it was this ran on 7 networks or something like that. I actually sort of think that if we can't have campaign finance reform, at least don't open every single channel. I'm a supporter of this guy, but it seemed kind of an unfair advantage that 30 minutes unchallenged, unequal timed could really take over the American airwaves. That sort of shouldn't be allowed, to my mind.
It was kind of rubbing it in. It's like the Karate Kid, Daniel Russo does the crane kick. Okay, we're cheering. We get it. And then he reaches down into that guy's heart and pulls it out and starts walking around the dojo with it.
Moving along, you thought Joe the Plumber would fade away after the last debate? Think again, my friends. Samuel Wurzelbacher, also known as Joe the Plumber, has become a central figure in the John McCain campaign as the candidate rails against Barack Obama's economic policies. Wurzelbacher has been speaking at the rallies as well. Joe's dominance in the McCain campaign, good news, bad news, or no news?
The thing that I think is really bad news is this idea. You know, I, for a brief time, covered Congress, and so I actually would interview people that, you know, were in Congress and the Senate, and I thought to myself, these people, even if you don't agree with maybe the decisions they make, they're not dumb people. There's this idea that somebody who's a plumber from Ohio somehow knows more about how to run this country than people who've spent 40 years trying to do it. And it's weird because now they're saying, at least he's saying he's interested in maybe running for Congress, and it seems like this line of reasoning only goes one direction, which is, you know, from the people like Joe the Plumber towards Washington. It's not like anyone's going, you know who would be a great bricklayer? Nancy Pelosi. I know she weighs 80 pounds and she can't lift her arms over her head. She knows nothing about masonry, but that's why she'd be such a great bricklayer. She brings a totally fresh approach to it. Like, nobody says that kind of stuff. It's only in the direction of the kind of Joe Plumbers of the world towards the really hard jobs like Congress or advising the president. So I don't know. It makes me crazy, but I still think it's kind of no news.
In a democracy, in an election, I think people like Joe the Plumber have a voice. You know, that's what makes this country wonderful, is that we are governed by the people. And, you know, the next president is not going to be king. And so you can challenge, you can discuss, you know, you can discuss the tax system, you can discuss Obama's ideas. And I think that was what's so beautiful about it, is you just had this random guy who had done his homework and he had an opinion, and now he has a platform. It's just kind of neat.
What is bad news, at least for McCain, is the fact that this particular fellow has failed to sort of bear the fruit of his early promise. It's the frequency with which McCain uses Joe the Plumber that I think is the most troubling and the most embarrassing. And it's, I hate to say it, but it's, it makes him seem geriatric. Like, you know, the out-of-touch uncle who gets you plastic farm animals for your 21st birthday because he remembered you liked them when you were four. You know what I mean? It's like, dude, you've got to stop talking about this guy. I don't care how old the guy is, but he does sound, it makes him seem truly like he has nothing else to talk about.
How about the fact that as of Wednesday morning, regardless of the outcome of the presidential election, we'll probably never hear from Joe the Plumber again. Good news, bad news, no news.
Oh, no, we will.
You think?
We'll hear his country album.
David, you will never hear his country album.
No, I probably won't.
Last topic. The economy has meant that candy companies are more reluctant to test new brands. 35 new chocolate products were available this year compared to 49 a year ago. Among sugar and gum confectioneries, it was down to 54 from 119. Is this good news, bad news, or no news?
As a conservative, I do not rejoice in change for the sake of change or diversity for the sake of diversity. I think just because something's new doesn't mean it's necessarily good. And so the fact that these candy manufacturers are sticking with the old familiar standbys, which is what you want when you go to someone's house, I think it's good news.
I think it is good news as well that if it took a, you know, essentially a global recession to finally send the message to the candy manufacturers that what we want is chocolate miniatures. And that the other candies that they try to foist upon us every season is, they are, and I'm allowed to say this as a homosexual with a pinched nerve, they're both lame and gay. And all we want is the chocolate miniatures.
I think that, you know, as they're reducing the variety of candy, they should just go all the way and they need to get rid of Lick-O-Maid.
Yes. Fun Dip.
Which is the powder.
Hey,
here's a good thing for kids. You know what's fun? A flavorful powder that comes in a little packet that you can spread all over the place.
Let's not get ugly.
That's like that's a good time. let's try to imprint that as early as possible.
Hold on a second. We may have controversy here. Lick-O-Maid proponent David Rakoff?
I like Lick-O-Maid. I enjoyed the citric acid tang of it.
And that awful little white stick. That doesn't really taste good.
Right.
Oh, yeah. You'll be chasing the dragon on that one. Starts out good, and then it's just you're holding something the size of a baby's tooth, thinking, where did my life go?
All right. Now the news of the week makes sense. Now we know what's going on. Panel, thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.
Luke Burbank hosts the radio show Too Beautiful to Live in Seattle and tries to lay off the Lick-O-Maid whenever he can. Nancy French is the author of A Red State of Mind. David Rakoff's latest book is Don't Get Too Comfortable, The Indignities of Coach Class, The Torments of Low Thread Count, The Never-Ending Quest for Artisanal Olive Oil, and Other First World Problems.
Weekend America, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
An unpopular war abroad, a faltering economy at home, America gets ready to vote. For Nixon or Humphrey? Learn from history ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe, and it's time to listen to your weekend soundtrack, the song that says the weekend to you. Our latest story comes from Mark Del Monte. His soundtrack is City Boy by Keb Moe.
I hear the sound, the sound of my shoes shuffling on out of town. Too many people, too many cars. Take me to Memphis, Mercury, or Mars.
Mark, what makes this your weekend soundtrack?
It pretty much describes what I'm doing in my life right now. For the last year, I've been traveling around the country looking for a place to live. And this song really kind of touched me.
How did you get to a point where you were traveling around the country for a year looking for a place to live?
I had lived in Florida and had to go home and tend to some elderly parental business, and I got to start someplace again.
A lot of people might go online and look up information on a few cities, maybe think about cities where they know a person or two. You did things a little differently.
I did. I set my parameters are this. I'm looking for a place that makes me smile, and it's one of the lines in Keb Moe's song here that says, I want to see the Milky Way, and I figure if I can see the Milky Way, I'm in the right place.
Now I don't want to be no prisoner, and I sure don't want to be no slave. I want to look out at night and see stars in the sky, the Little Dipper and the Milky Way.
What have been some of the highlights of the trip so far?
Just walking out in the desert one night. And it was in New Mexico, southern New Mexico. And I had a GPS. I just logged my starting point, and I just let the desert take me wherever it wanted to. And for 3 hours, it was almost one of those magical experiences.
I want to feel the dirt under my feet. I wanna go where the buffalo roam.
So did you finally settle on a place?
I did. Let's call it a region, and it's centered around Asheville, North Carolina. If you could see what I'm seeing today, it's in absolute beautiful fall color. There's reds and yellows and golds. The sunshine is out. The winds shimmering the trees. It's a wonderful place to be right now.
How are you different today than you were a year ago?
John, I wake up and I smile every day. and I don't have a lot of stress on my life. And I'm living very much in the present. And it's something that I've never done before in my life. And it's I find this extremely refreshing and enjoyable. I think it's extremely good for us all to do that every now and then.
I'm just a city boy looking for a home. City boy looking for a home.
Mark Del Monte, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Mark Del Monte's weekend soundtrack, City Boy by Keb Moe. Keb Moe is no relation to me. I don't sing that well. We want to hear your weekend soundtrack as well. Maybe it's a song that you heard on a long ago weekend getaway. Maybe it's a song that you just putter around town with now, running errands, doing your weekend thing. Go to our website. There's a link up there on the upper right-hand side. You can find out all the information on how to submit your soundtrack, weekendamerica.org.
Thank you.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
It's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. 40 years ago, America faced a presidential election in the midst of an unpopular war, a sliding economy, and cities fraught with racial tension. 1968 was a violent, wrenching election year and an important one in American politics. As we enter the final days of Campaign 2008, we spoke to documentary producer Stephen Smith of American Radio Works. He's just produced a new program called Campaign 68, and I asked him about what mattered going into Election Day.
Well, the issue was the Vietnam War, and the incumbent president, Democrat Lyndon Johnson, had actually declined to run for re-election because his escalation of the war had been so unpopular.
I will neither seek nor accept.
That's right. Johnson, however, had a powerful desire as he was leaving office to cut a peace deal with communist North Vietnam, not so much to help the Democrat who was running, which was his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, but to leave behind a legacy of peace rather than a hopeless war. So just 5 days before the election, President Johnson announced a halt to the bombing of North Vietnam.
So Johnson isn't in the race. What did that mean for Humphrey and for Nixon? How did they respond?
Well, for Humphrey, it was good news. He had been fighting a losing battle to prove that he was sort of free of Johnson's shadow, that he wasn't just carrying on Johnson's policies. Humphrey had been supporting Johnson's Vietnam policy for many years, and it was hard for him to get away from that. Nixon, on the other hand, had been saying all along that he would stick to the high road. He would not comment on the possibility of a peace deal in Vietnam because he was above that. He was above that kind of politics. And he would stay neutral about Johnson's peace initiatives.
I will only say what I have said previously, that I trust that this action may bring some progress in those talks. And I will say further, my friends, that as a presidential candidate and my vice presidential running mate joins me in this, neither he nor I will say anything that might destroy the chance to have peace. We want peace above politics in America.
The thing was that while Nixon was keeping publicly quiet about the peace process, he had a private deal going on of his own. Through back channels, Nixon was actually sabotaging this peace deal, slowing it down, because the last thing he wanted coming up to the election was to have an announcement about peace in Vietnam.
So the war was obviously a huge issue in the presidential contest, especially there towards the end, it sounds like. Was this the issue? Was this the decisive issue about the campaign?
The war was an enormous issue in 1968, and it was an enormous problem for Hubert Humphrey, more than it was a problem for Richard Nixon. But there were two other big issues in 68 that were also hugely important. One was the national economy, which was beginning to slide into recession, and many Americans were very uneasy about that. Sound familiar?
Yes.
And then there was the issue of race. There was a third-party candidate in 1968 named George Wallace, the former governor of Alabama, who skillfully played the race card in his campaign to get support from conservative whites in the South and many working-class whites in northern industrial states. And in our program, you can hear how Wallace worked that issue.
I want to say this about race tonight, because each place that I go, I'm asked that question, and I think that this will suffice. I have never in my life made a statement or a speech that reflected upon anybody because of race, color, creed, religion, or national origin. And I don't intend to do so tonight.
The trick Wallace used was to avoid making direct statements about race. Historian Dan Carter wrote a book about Wallace called The Politics of Rage. Carter says Wallace talked about race in a kind of political code that his audience clearly understood.
So that, for example, he gets up and says, I don't care if a homeowner doesn't want to sell his home to a blue-eyed Japanese, then that's perfectly all right with me. Well, everyone knows he's not really talking about a blue-eyed Japanese. He's talking about an African-American. But when people complain that it's racism, he can play the role of the innocent. I haven't even mentioned race, and yet you're accusing me of being a racist. So he certainly wasn't the only politician who did this, but he was the first one to really master the technique, I think.
Wallace used another wedge from the populist tool bag. He pitted white working-class people against big-shot establishment elites, intellectuals, and government bureaucrats.
Yes, they've looked down their nose at you and me a long time. They've called us rednecks, the Republicans and the Democrats. Well, we're going to show Mr. Nixon and Mr. Humphrey that there's sure a lot of rednecks in this country.
Well, that language really jumps out at you, Stephen, but George Wallace lost in 1968.
Wallace lost, but he did get something like 10 million votes. And more importantly, Republican Richard Nixon, who won, also played on the racial fears of white Americans. He ran a law and order campaign that sounded some of the same themes as Wallace, but didn't sound as extremist. Historians say that Nixon's campaign in 68 and when he got reelected again in 1972 perfected the use of what has become very familiar to us, the use of wedge politics. The strategy was not so much to unify voters under your banner, but to divide the people who might otherwise support your opponent, in this case, the Democratic opponent. Nixon's strategy led to the rise of a voting base that would become known as Reagan Democrats and would fuel what was essentially a conservative Republican domination of American politics and government that lasted really ever since 1968.
We've been talking about the new American Radio Works documentary, Campaign 68, produced by Stephen Smith and Kate Ellis. More about the 68 election and learn more about the documentary, that's at weekinamerica.org. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
This week marked the anniversary of the stock market crash of October 29th, 1929. That led to the Great Depression, of course. Yesterday, one of America's greatest documenters of the Depression died, Studs Terkel. His book, Hard Times, was based on interviews with hundreds of people. Our producer, Sasha Aslanian, interviewed Terkel 8 years ago in Chicago.
So I'm interviewing one of the wise men of Wall Street. His name was Sidney Weinberg, senior partner of Goldman Sachs. He's a wise man, right? So I'm going to, what happened, I say to him. He's, I don't know. I said, don't know. He's, what happened is the ticker tape was going all night. Let me read it to you. I remember the day, he says to me, October 29, 1929. I remember that day very intimately. I stayed in the office a week without going home. Everybody was stunned. Nobody knew what it was all about. The street had general confusion. They didn't understand it any more than anybody else. They thought something should be announced. And that's when I thought to myself, announced by whom, God? You know, well, it was announced, of course. The government stepped in and saved the butts of the daddies and granddaddies, the very ones who condemn big government today.
Studs Terkel died yesterday at 96. We asked you for your memories of the Depression as well, and like Studs, we heard an incredible array of experiences, some of them happy.
I'm Mickey Schill, born Lorna Simpson, and I was born in San Fernando, California in 1927. We would take smelling rides in the summer, and you drive by these huge strawberry fields and just about pass out from the smell. It was so wonderful. And we would take rides through the orange orchards in the spring and for the orange blossom smells. And so all of that went into our cafeteria, and we ate very, very well there. By the evening, people would show up at the farm and talk politics because, of course, in the Depression, everybody was a politician. And my grandfather would play fiddle. His hands were all loosened up by then and play fiddle, and they'd argue politics and laughing and carrying on. It was a lot of fun. I really thought they got a lot out of life, made a lot out of life with what they had.
My name is Dottie Thompson, Dorothea Thompson, and I'm in Birmingham, Alabama now, but I grew up in Meridian, Mississippi, and that's where I have my memories of the Depression era. I never heard people talk about a lack of money, but you could tell it because we had all of these men, mostly, I don't ever remember a woman, but men would come to our back door begging for food. Some of them wanted to work for food, and some of them just wanted food. But my mother cooked 3 meals every day, and she would always give them food, and they would eat on our back porch. And one of the things that they really liked were sandwiches made on light bread. They thought that was a real delicacy. So everybody seemed to be kinder and gentler and more involved with their neighbors. But that may have been just because I was 4 or 5 years old.
My name is Joan Bloom, and I am from Boulder, Colorado. We lived in Troy, New York, and we certainly weren't like the poor Jobs in the Grapes of Wrath, but... And I think we always had food to eat, but I think the stress of the time probably affected my mother, and my mother just left us. We were 5 and 4 years old, maybe a little younger. And nobody gave children explanations in those days. My father had to go and work. There was a flood in Paducah, Kentucky. So we had no idea whether he had died or had just left us too. But the thing I remember is we had a family whistle, and he was, we didn't know when he was coming home from the flood, fighting the flood. And I was sitting in the toilet, and I remember this, and I heard his whistle. And I jumped out the window, right through the screen, right into his arms. It was like a resurrection to have him appear and to hear that whistle.
Joan Bloom of Boulder, Colorado, Dottie Thompson of Birmingham, Alabama, and Mickey Schell of Grand Marais, Minnesota. Want to have a little fun this weekend? Maybe enjoy the weather? Here's Jeannie Yandel.
Groundnut, goober, earthnut, monkey nut. All are names for peanuts, and all will be celebrated at the National Peanut Festival in Dothan, Alabama. 74 and Sunny for music, Miss Peanut Pageant, and peanut-themed parade. I can only assume Mr. Peanut is the Grand Marshal of the Peanut Parade with his little top hat and monocle. This must be the biggest day of his life. Thanksgiving is the Olympics of eating, but you can't get to the Olympics without training. That's where Forest Grove, Oregon's Robert Sausage Festival comes in. All you can eat sausage and sauerkraut. Cloudy and 58 for eating and eating and eating, and then falling to the ground, holding your crampy stomach, yelling, "Dear God, why did I eat so much?" If you're not sick enough, there's home-cooked candy and pie available. Also, hand-embroidered sweatpants. Once jack-o'-lantern season's over, pumpkins aren't very exciting. But Queen Creek, Arizona wants to discover the pumpkin's inner rock star at the Pumpkin and Chili Party. 90 and sunny for pumpkins, obviously, including a huge talking animatronic pumpkin monster thingy. Also, chili cook-offs and pig races judged by that huge talking animatronic pumpkin monster thingy. And mini golf, but you have to beat that huge talking animatronic pumpkin monster thingy. You know what? Maybe pumpkins shouldn't be pushed to find their inner rock star. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure is a fun movie, at least until that trucker lady's eyes bulge out of her head. More scary childhood movie memories next on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm John Moe. On last week's show, I talked about Bigfoot, more specifically a really cheesy Bigfoot movie that I saw when I was 8 years old and that made me terrified of Bigfoot for years, and which I arguably have still not recovered from. I talked about how other people have the same feelings about those terrible flying monkeys from The Wizard of Oz, you know. And I invited you, dear listener, to go to our website and share your own scary childhood movie memories. Well, our website was swamped. We were flooded with these cathartic cinematic purgings. We got more comments than any story I can remember. Our website had become a kind of support group / therapy session / story slam. And some of the memories that people had were just so weird and funny and sad sometimes. I wanted to call up some of these people and talk to them. Kelly Collier of St. Louis, Missouri, recalled going to see E.T. at age 4. It didn't go well.
When he got sick, it was terrifying. And then when the men in the white suits with the guns came over the hill, I freaked out. We were asked to leave the theater. It was absolutely terrifying. My grandfather tried to take me to see it a second time, and the same thing happened, except I threw up. Then my family tried a third time, and with the same result. I'm in my 30s. I still haven't seen the end of E.T., and it's so bad that when the 25th anniversary edition came out, I was sitting in a theater, and the preview for it came on, and when the men in the white suits came over the hill, tears started streaming down my face.
Do you have kids, Kelly?
I have a 4-year-old daughter, and I don't think I'm going to let her watch it.
Does she know what E.T. is?
She does. My brother actually went to Disneyland in California and brought home brought home a E.T. doll for her, and I made it stay at my parents' house. I won't have it in the house.
Because if you had it in the house, the government men would show up at your house?
I recognize that wouldn't happen, but it just freaks me out. The same way when people come up behind me and go, ooh, touch, and like touch the back of my neck, it makes me cringe and gives me the heebie-jeebies.
As I heard someone say in a movie once, ouch.
Hey, that's not funny.
E.T. has really joined the Wizard of Oz tradition of movies kids are supposed to like until something goes horribly wrong. Andrea Dixon of Seattle remembers it too.
I really liked E.T., but I was terrified when he turned all white and the government agents were keeping him on ice. I stood up in the middle of the theater and shouted, "You told me that he wasn't going to die," and then stormed out when my parents laughed at me. I had a habit of getting upset at the death of movie characters, which is why my father had calmed my incessant whining when Bambi's mother is shot by assuring me that she had merely been kidnapped.
Did your father think kidnapped would somehow be better than being killed?
Apparently, yeah. I don't know if I knew what that meant either at that age. I mean, I couldn't have been more than 3. But I think it was a word other than dead.
Did it work? Did it?
Oh, completely. I was totally sated. And I assured all the other children around me who were crying that it was not a big deal. She was just kidnapped.
It's only a kidnapping.
Yeah,
it's fine.
Guys, get on board.
It's
please.
A mere abduction. The more I think about it, the more it makes sense that kids would react this way. Kids' minds are totally open. They don't have the biases and defenses that adults do. So when something exceptionally strange comes along, Bigfoot, E.T., a flying monkey, it hits much deeper. It becomes plausible. And sometimes that hit goes really deep, like it did with Dennis McCartan of Narragansett, Rhode Island.
I have to agree that the flying monkeys are the first things that come to mind when I'm asked about scary movie moments of my childhood. But I now know that I've suppressed a more terrifying movie experience. This realization surfaced recently when I sat down to enjoy Disney's Pinocchio with my 3-year-old granddaughter. I relived the entire experience of watching this movie for the first time when I was 8 or 9 years old. The whole movie is dark, about abduction, drunkenness, debauchery. But when Pinocchio was swallowed by the whale, I realized that this movie introduced me to the concept of despair. It was and is an awful experience.
When I read through your comments online, I was struck by how strongly worded these things were. The full force of years of fear just comes bursting out, like it did with Matt Franks of Davis, California.
I'm sorry, but the all-time scariest moment in a so-called children's movie is Large Marge from Pee-wee's Big Adventure. As an 8-year-old, I had nightmares for years about this scene. Pee-wee gets picked up by a trucker, who turns out to be a ghost. But before he gets out, she turns to him and to the audience, and her face turns into a horrifying monster. Bulgy eyes, snake-like tongue and all. I'm definitely sparing my children from that image.
I've got this scene pulled up on YouTube now.
Yeah, what do you think?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Holy cats.
Yeah.
Wow, this is like my wife's favorite movie.
And, really?
Yeah, and she wanted to, she keeps trying to get our kids to watch it.
Yeah, no.
I just timed out this section that we're talking about, you know how long it is?
How long?
1 second.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's part of it, too. It's just like you don't really know what you saw. You know, it's just like so fast and so out of nowhere that it's all that more terrifying.
Well, I know what you're thinking. Wait a minute. That's not the scariest childhood movie moment. Everybody knows the right answer is... Now it's up to you. Go to weekendamerica.org, fill in that right answer, set us straight. Oh, I'm glad Halloween's over. So that means next up is Thanksgiving. We're working on a story that maybe you could help us with. We're looking for vegetarians who stray around the holidays. Maybe you're normally diligent about your vegetarianism, but then there's turkey or some sweet, tender ham. One thing leads to another. Tell us your stories. Tales of alluring meat. Go to weekendamerica.org. It's at the bottom of the page there. That's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Rob Byers, who dressed as a microphone for Halloween, Chris Wieg, who is a different kind of microphone for Halloween. Hey, we work in radio. Sam Keenan, Michael May, Hillary Frank. Michael Rayfield didn't have time to dress up for Halloween. He was editing waterfowl recordings. Chrissy Clark, Desiree Cooper, who is a gypsy because she's always a gypsy, Brendan Noonan, Ocean Kalen, Ariel Kitsch, Angela Kim. Angela Kim was Gogo Yubari from Kill Bill Volume 1, and Mark Sanchez, a.k.a. Oates, from Hall & Oates. Apparently, he could go for that. Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program from our website, weekendamerica.org. It's also available on iTunes. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independence in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, this is John Moe, host of Weekend America. The weekend has its own schedule, and it definitely has its own soundtrack that moves you along.
When I'm out training on the weekends for triathlons and marathons, and all I have to rely on is that mental drive at some point because my body's going to start to get a little tired, I just play this song.
Join us and hear exactly what the weekend sounds like on Weekend America.